Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Femi Okay.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Femi, there are some new developments on the Trump administration's family separation policy. This morning, First Lady Melania Trump made an unannounced visit to a detention center in McAllen, Texas, where some immigrant children are being held, separated from their parents. She spoke with workers there.
We all know they're here without their families. And I want to thank you for your hard work, your compassion, and your kindness you're giving them in these difficult times.
And at a cabinet meeting at the White House today, President Trump said he is directing government agencies to reunite immigrant families that have been separated. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting that the Trump administration will temporarily stop prosecuting parents who cross into the U.S. illegally with children. But a Justice Department official tells Reuters that report is inaccurate.
Mm-hmm. In a moment, I will be talking to the BBC about problems with immigration in Hungary. They almost reflect what's happening right here in the U.S. But first, Jeremy.
Looking forward to that. But first, let's bring in Scott Detrow, NPR congressional correspondent in Washington. Scott, a lot of developments today. Let's start with that Washington Post report. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I just saw the denial from the Department of Justice that you mentioned. They're saying flat out this report is wrong, that the Washington Post had not talked to the Department of Justice. But you have to say, given how many misstatements and how many policy reversals have happened, particularly on immigration itself, it's really unclear right now. And I think we'll all be asking a lot more questions going forward. Regardless, whether or not the administration is changing the way it prosecutes people crossing the border illegally, there's a lot of questions and a lot of uncertainty about what happens going forward now that President Trump has signed this order. Chief among them, how long will it take and what is the process for reuniting those more than 2,000 children who were already separated from their families?
Right. What Melania Trump was talking about there. Let's listen to the president speaking today at this cabinet meeting.
I signed a very good executive order yesterday, but that's only limited. No matter how you cut it, it leads to separation ultimately. I'm directing HHS, DHS, and DOJ to work together to keep illegal immigrant families together during the immigration process and to reunite these previously separated groups.
Scott, what do we know about that process? What is it going to take to reunite these kids? You know, in some cases, they're so young, they may not even know their parents' names.
Yeah, and there was a lot of reporting and a lot of questions about the process of keeping track and notifying parents and children and what the exact steps were in order to figure out where children were and how the reunification was taking place. I think it's uncertain. I think there's a lot of stuff that has been happening on the fly from the beginning. There's a lot of similarities in a way to the travel ban that went in place in the first few weeks of the Trump administration. The administration in that process wanted to make a big statement, wrote a hastily drafted executive order, and departments simply had no idea how to implement it. Not quite as extreme as the confusion that happened in early 2017 with this, but it's the same storyline. There's just a lot of uncertainty and a lot of decisions being made at the last minute. You know, President Trump was giving hardline speech after hardline speech this week saying that the administration would not back down from this policy, that they didn't even have the option to if they wanted to, and then went ahead and did exactly that and signed this order saying we will no longer separate families.
What about the issue of asylum seekers, people who come across the border and say, I'm seeking asylum, my country is plagued with violence or something like that? Dick Durbin, the Democratic senator, said the executive order criminalizes asylum seekers. Is that true?
I'm not sure about that. I have not gotten into that level of detail. We've been tracking a few big immigration votes in the House today. But when it comes to that asylum seeking, the administration has been saying for weeks, for months really, that that's the proper channel, that you need to go through these official ports of entry and ask for asylum. But NPR reported, and others have reported as well, that at these border entry points, people are being denied entry, being told there's no room to even come up and present yourself. And those that pathway seems to be being blocked for a lot of people.
So what's happening in Congress? They're planning to vote on some immigration legislation.
Yeah, this is a big test of House Speaker Paul Ryan's leadership today. These are a couple different broader bills that address DACA, that add money for border security. Both of the measures that are going to be voted on do have language prohibiting the federal government from separating families who are arrested crossing the border illegally. But Paul Ryan admitted as much earlier today that this is really more about political symbolism than anything else. There's a lot of uncertainty about whether these measures will pass because Republicans are always so divided on immigration and Democrats aren't supporting them as well. Ryan said that his main goal here was to head off a push from moderate House Republicans who wanted to force a vote on a more narrow issue. And he said that he's allowing members the chance to express themselves by voting for the policies they want to see.
It's NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
The debate over immigration is going on around the world. In Europe, Hungary's parliament passed a package of laws yesterday that includes jail time for anyone convicted of helping a person who enters the country illegally. Prime Minister Viktor Orban is pushing the hard line. Orban and his government have dubbed the legislation the Stop Soros Law because they believe the US billionaire is orchestrating migration to Europe. The BBC's Nick Thorpe joins us from Budapest. And Nick, tell us more about this Stop Soros Law. What does it do?
Basically, it amends 8 existing laws. So laws on things like the police, on asylum, on the organisation of Hungary's border police. Issues like this. And it also, perhaps most alarmingly for its critics, it introduces a new criminal offence into the penal code here in Hungary, namely that of facilitating illegal immigration. What that means is activities that human rights groups, NGOs, especially those funded by George Soros and the Open Society Foundations, because this is one of the areas that they work in, organisations that help asylum seekers in Hungary, will be penalised in future with jail sentences of up to a year, in some cases more than a year, if they are advocating, campaigning for, or practically helping asylum seekers in Hungary, and effectively saying that these human rights groups are little better than the smugglers to whom the migrants or refugees have paid money to bring them this far.
Nick, there's been international criticism about these new laws because they deliberately target migrants and refugees, or at least it seems to be that way. What's the reaction to these new laws inside Hungary?
For the past 3 years, the government has been organising national consultations. These are effectively questionnaires sent to all Hungarian households suggesting that refugees, asylum seekers, are in fact economic migrants, that they represent they're increasing the terror threat to Hungarian households and to Hungarian society, and also that this is an attempt by George Soros and his foundations to effectively change the ethnic composition, not only of Hungary, but of the whole of Europe, by encouraging immigration from people of different cultures and civilizations, especially of Muslims. And certainly the Hungarian population seem to believe this. They voted the Orban government back into power with a massive majority on April the 8th this year. And this anti-immigration campaign was pretty much the only subject raised during that election campaign by the Orban government.
Where does this idea that George Soros is orchestrating migration to Europe, where does that come from? Where's the evidence, Nick?
They've taken 4 or 5 short paragraphs from statements made by George Soros over the past few years. For example, one from September 2015, in which he said that Europe should take in 1 million refugees or asylum seekers in the humanitarian disaster that was threatening that summer. But they've taken Mr. Soros himself has said, they've taken his comments out of context. They haven't focused on what he's issued as later comments as the situation changed, as less people started coming to Europe. For example, that there should not be a compulsory quota system. He always said that this should be a voluntary relocation of people to Europe and only of the most needy. The government has focused on the real words of Mr. Soros, but certainly their critics would say they've taken them well out of context and used them to concoct what, again, their critics regard as a conspiracy theory against him.
You're right there in Budapest. I'm just wondering, what's happening in Hungary right now? How does that fit into the bigger picture of immigration and handling immigration across Europe?
The first irony of this story is that there are almost no immigrants at all in Hungary. Since 2015, when Hungary built its fence on the southern border with Serbia and partly with Croatia, it's allowed very, very few people into the country, and they are put into what are called transit zones behind razor wire fences, so they cannot proceed into the country at all until either they're granted some form of protection or they're pushed back into Serbia. So most ordinary Hungarians have never met an asylum seeker. But of course, this is a wider issue, as you say, about immigration into Europe as a whole. Hungary has one of the lowest, I think only Romania has less people in its among its population who are actually born outside the borders of the country. And so people have very little experience of living with people of different cultures or civilizations. There's no multicultural society. It's a very homogenous society in Hungary. And therefore, people have little experience of this. And so it's been relatively easy for the Hungarian government to say, this is who we are and we want to keep it this way.
The BBC's Nick Thorpe in Budapest. Nick, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Mexico's presidential election is just a week and a half away, and leftist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador is leading in the polls over his challengers and seems likely to be Mexico's next president. Joining us now by Skype from Mexico City is Carlos Puig, who is the host of a news program on Milenio TV and a columnist for Milenio Diario. Carlos, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hello, how are you doing? Nice to be back.
Great to have you back with us. And tell us, first of all, about López Obrador. He was the mayor of Mexico City. This is his third time running for president. He narrowly lost in 2006 and 2012.
Yes, he lost two times. Both of those times he was the second place. In 2006, he was very close, half a point away from becoming president. He was not that good in 2012. And now every single poll since January, puts López Obrador in first place by a margin that goes between 5 and 10 points. Remember polls now after Brexit, after what happened in the U.S.,
right,
are not the best way to go, but it's been impressive in the way that every single poll in the last 6 months says that it's going to be a huge win for Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
Well, and if the polls are right, what is he tapping into there in Mexico?
Well, I think he's tapping in this sentiment that Mexicans are tired of a lot of years of corruption and a lot of years of violence without no solution. And I think López Obrador this time, he said that kind of the same thing 6 and 12 years ago. But I think this time he's tapping into a real sentiment of people are angry. People are tired of at least 12 years of our government saying, we're going to fix it, and we know it's wrong, and we're going to fix it, and nothing is happening. This is a guy that has been with us for now. In 2000, he became the mayor of Mexico City, and since then, the leader of the opposition. So 18 years later, I think he's going to become president on July 1st.
And what is he going to do about those problems? He said that his victory would usher in the start of Mexico's fourth revolution.
Well, that's what he says. He sees victory as what he says, the fourth transformation after independence, civil war, revolution. And now he sees this is going to be the fourth one. I think what he's lacking now is, okay, how are you going to fix these problems that are much more complicated? So he always says, oh, corruption, I'm not corrupt, so that's going to help. I don't know if that's going to be the case. Those things are much more complicated. As violence and insecurity in Mexico, he says that we have to have kind of an amnesty, reconciliation, talking with some of those criminals, not putting everybody in jail. But nothing is clear because that's how this campaign has been.
So tell us about his rivals, Ricardo Anaya and José Antonio Meade.
Yes, José Antonio Meade is a representative of the government. He was Treasury Secretary for the last two governments. He has been Foreign Relations Secretary also. I mean, he's a guy that has been, he's a very serious, well-prepared guy, but he represents the government. And I think that's why things have not gone well for him, because he represents the status quo. He represents everything that people are angry at. So I don't think he's going to do well. And then Ricardo Anaya is the younger of the three. He's proposing a more center agenda. He's young. He's very well prepared. I think two of the three debates he won. But I don't think it's going to be enough. I think this is, I mean, all the polls say it. Every kind of poll we see, López Obrador is ahead by enough.
So López Obrador is on the left, but he has been compared to President Trump. Is that fair?
No, I mean, I don't think it's fair. I think you can compare the two phenomenons in terms that he's tapping into some angriness. But I don't think it has nothing to do with Trump in terms of some of the things that Donald Trump does every day.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a little bit of López Obrador speaking at a rally in April. Now, just for background, of course, we know that President Trump has said that Mexico is going to pay for his border wall. The Mexican president has said Mexico will not pay. Here's López Obrador.
¿Qué se puede resolver el problema de la migración?
Migration and violence can be fixed if there's development and cooperation between both nations, so there's employment and well-being. Problems can't be fixed with walls or border militarization.
How much has Trump come up in the campaign?
It has come up every time he does something. I mean, every time he talks about NAFTA, every time he talks about migration, then the candidates have to respond. And then the second debate that was held in Tijuana, one of the themes to be discussed there was migration and the relationship with the U.S. So what we haven't heard from the candidates here, it's a real answer to Donald Trump. How are you going to confront this guy that is doing what he's doing? I mean, the best example is what's going on with the kids and the separation of the kids from their parents. We haven't heard any candidate say nothing about it.
Well, why do you think that is? Why are they holding back on that?
Because first, it would be very easy just to, you know, no, get the flag and say, well, Mexico, man. And then the second thing is we are the largest trading partner. We have a lot of things that we do together. And there's not an easy solution to deal with Donald Trump. And now they know.
So to the Americans listening to this right now on our side of the border, what would you say to them about why this Mexican election matters in the United States?
I think this election matters because when things go well in Mexico, I think part of the U.S. reaps the benefits of that. I mean, what the U.S. doesn't want, it's a Mexico that is in turmoil with more people trying to go into the U.S., with insecurity, drug trafficking going crazy. Because that actually has an impact in what goes in terms of drugs and in the U.S. So I think Americans should be concerned that things go well in Mexico in the next 6 years, whoever wins. Because life is much easier when you have a neighbor that is stable, that is doing well, that people are have jobs, et cetera, et cetera.
And do you think that that's likely to happen under López Obrador if he wins?
Well, I think things are going to change in Mexico. And I think we have a chance. We do have an opportunity with either three if they win. It's a matter of how they operate. There's going to be a learning curve, of course, but I think we can do well, and I certainly hope we do well in the next years.
That's Carlos Puig joining us from Mexico City. He's host of a news program on Milenio TV and a columnist for Milenio Diario. Carlos, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, major flooding is once again hitting parts of Texas less than a year after Hurricane Harvey devastated many cities and towns in the state. Flash flood warnings were issued in parts of coastal southeast Texas, and the threat remains high in places like Corpus Christi. Corpus Christi Police Chief Mike Markle is helping the city manage the flooding. He joins us. Chief Markle, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
And how bad is the flooding today?
Today, we're subsiding a little bit today. You know, we've had a little break in the weather. It did get pretty bad as far as rainfall, went up to 20 inches in some of the surrounding areas, 10 to 15 within the city over the 3-4 day period. So it was a significant rainfall for us.
And people all along the coast there in Texas are dealing with flooding now. And of course, we remember this is not long after Hurricane Harvey really caused a lot of flooding and damage there.
That's correct.
So what are some of the biggest concerns you have right now in terms of damage?
damage right now is, you know, keeping our roadways open, and we're concerned making sure our citizens stay out of roads they can't see and, you know, having a fatality or serious injury. We've done a great job over the last couple years in the city fixing our stormwater drainage system, so it's keeping up. So right now, as far as infrastructure goes, you know, there's some minor things, but we're doing well. No loss of life. That's always the most important thing.
Right.
As far as structure goes, you know, it's keeping roadways open. We've had some roof failures and those things on a residential basis, but we're doing pretty good overall.
Have you had to do any rescues, people that do go into the water where they shouldn't?
We spent the first night doing a great many rescues and pulling vehicles out. Got those cleared up. Fire department and the police department did a tremendous job. Of course, we know how to prepare for these events at this point. We stage high water vehicles in the areas that we know flood through history. We stage barricades for the roadways that we know flood during rain events. So we were prepared, and we were prepared to do those types of extractions too.
And does this feel normal to you, or how does this compare to years past?
This is a significant rain event. It's not normal. You know, we go for long periods without rain here, but operationally, we are prepared because it's happened many times over the many years. So we know what we're doing when it comes to this as a city.
And how's the forecast looking at this point? It sounds like you're going to get some relief pretty soon.
We'll get some relief, I think, by the end of the day, probably into the evening. Like I said, our stormwater system is keeping up at this point and draining out the streets as we speak. So I think we're on the road to, you know, a safe environment.
Although I saw in one forecast for your area that they're predicting steam in the next few days because it'll get hot and there's all this water on the ground.
That's exactly right. So we're going to have a lot of heat. It's going to be lots of steam, and following that, of course, there are lots of mosquitoes. So we have in place a mosquito abatement plan. Those teams are ready to go. Equipment's being checked, staged. Chemicals are being made ready. So we have a sequence of things that are going to happen from here, too.
That's Mike Markle, who is the police chief in Corpus Christi, Texas. Chief, thank you so much and good luck.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the call.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This. And on our latest episode, how Chip Wilson turned workout clothes into a fashion statement. And along the way, built a breakout brand, Lululemon, now worth billions. You can listen to How I Built This on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts.
We talk sports every week with Mike Pesca, who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And today we're going to talk about baseball and basketball. But our guest host this week, Femi Okeh, really thinks we're missing the mark here.
Only the world's biggest sports event, the World Cup.
How did we miss that? Well, let's start there, Femi.
A couple of things that caught my eye. It's the drama on the pitch and the drama off the pitch. But out of all of the 32 teams, Mike, Jeremy, there's only one black coach, and he has the best meme. He's the coach for Senegal, and if you look him up, he just does this amazing, stylish, yes! You'll see that, because a Senegal team beat Poland just recently. So everybody is celebrating. That is my pick from the World Cup. Mike, what's yours?
Well, I love Iceland because Iceland's the smallest country by a factor of 10. It has 350,000 people, and we know that, and maybe 350,000 seems more than we could fit in a room, but that is the population of Bakersfield, California.
Fantastic.
So imagine if Bakersfield, California tied Argentina a couple days ago. It's amazing.
Iceland plays Nigeria on Saturday. Don't ask me why I know that.
Because she's a representative of the world.
Of course.
Yes, a classic Eagles versus Vikings matchup. This is not the NFC Championship game. This is Iceland and Nigeria.
Okay, Mike, we said we would talk about baseball, so I want to ask you about that, because there's a Wall Street Journal report that says Major League Baseball attendance is down more than 8%. What's going on?
Yes, and it's the biggest attendance decline since the year after the strike season in 95, and it's part of a long trend. Baseball's been declining down, but this has come in a bunch. I think maybe by the time things smooth out after better weather, it will be not as precipitous a decline, but it just doesn't seem like a sport that is in keeping with the rhythms of our lives in 2018.
Slow.
It is too slow, and there are also a bunch of teams that are losing on purpose, and so random randomly, if you go to a game, you're likely to see, you know, the White Sox or the Reds or the Marlins or one of these teams that just is happy to lose 100 games, and that's not good. And the last thing I'd say is they're terrible at marketing their star players. And Mike Trout is a better baseball player compared to everyone else in the league than anyone in the NBA. So he is so light years above everyone in baseball. And I would gather, I would venture to say if most Americans saw a picture of Mike Trout, they wouldn't know who the guy was. And everyone should.
One more thing. The NBA draft is tonight. The Phoenix Suns have the first pick. They have missed the playoffs 8 straight seasons. They really have to get this right tonight, don't they?
I would think, and it will probably, or I would say almost definitely, be DeAndre Ayton, who played at the University of Arizona and then was caught up in a little bit of a scandal, but that scandal was about being compensated for his time. Guess what? You go to the NBA, that is part of the deal. You get a nice big contract. And I don't think the Suns, even though they haven't been good for a long time, I don't think that they are one of these teams that just has such a dysfunctional management that they can't get good in a hurry. The West is hard, but Ayton can help them a lot.
Is LeBron going to go to L.A.?
I can't say if he will. How often have we all been burned by making a LeBron prediction? I will make one prediction. When he announces it, it won't be in a televised special with a bunch of Boys and Girls Club kids in the background. That I know.
Where he says, I'm taking my talents to
right.
That's Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, editor of the new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
When Elizabeth Catkin and her husband decided to have children, they started on a quest that took 9 years and multiple medical procedures. They did end up with 2 healthy children, but on the way, Elizabeth Catkin realised how little she knew about infertility. So she started to do some research and investigate. Now she shares the results in a new book that's part memoir and part how-to manual for others also looking for answers. It's called Conceivability: What I Learned Exploring the Frontiers of Fertility. Elizabeth Catkin joins us to talk about it. And Elizabeth, reading the book, it sounds as though you had to get pregnant by any means.
Well, I definitely didn't start out as a person who felt like, oh, I have to have a baby no matter what. Part of what happened to me is that I did get pregnant and things kept going wrong. And I was a little bit like a dog with a bone. I mean, it was a science project for me. No one could explain why I couldn't get pregnant easily, and more than that, no one could explain why I kept miscarrying. So each time I would get pregnant and then I would miscarry, I would think, well, I just got pregnant, I can do it again. And I just sort of kept trying. It was like, you know, a hamster in a habit trail, and you can't get out.
You make a list in the introduction to the book which gives people a sense of how difficult your journey to being a mom actually was. Can you recite the list?
Wow. Let's see. It's quite a list. I had 7 miscarriages. I did IVF 10 times. That was 8 fresh IVF cycles and 2 frozen. I had 5 natural pregnancies. So that natural was without assistance at all. 4 IVF pregnancies. I saw 10 doctors, 4 of whom insisted I give up trying. In 6 countries, I worked with 2 potential surrogates. It took us 9 years. My husband and I spent close to $200,000.
That's just extraordinary to listen to that. One of the things you did was that you shopped around. You didn't say, I'm just going to stay in my state. I'm just going to stay in the US. I'm going to look to see who can help me.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
You know, I was very lucky. I had a benefit a lot of women and couples don't have, which is that my job took me overseas for nearly a decade, and I had the opportunity to live in different countries. I first was living in London and seeing doctors in London and also traveling back to the U.S. I think like many people, I stuck with what's familiar. And like many Americans, we're kind of trained to think that the medical care here is likely to be the best or as good as anywhere else in the world. So I was living in Europe and traveling back to the States. And after several years of frustration and failure, it was actually some clients. I had a wonderful client based in Geneva who had 3 children, and she was saying, why don't you come to Geneva and talk to the doctors here? And so it sounds a little extravagant that I traveled to so many countries. I lived in London and Moscow and Dubai throughout all the years of this treatment, and because I was living overseas, I really had the opportunity to learn a lot about how other countries viewed the problem.
Where did you find was the most affordable place to have IVF? I could only actually ask that question to you because you traveled so far. It's a bit like you shopped around Europe and you found what?
I actually found, much to my shock, true shock, that not only the most affordable, but in, you know, largely the most effective was in Russia. So my son was conceived at an IVF clinic in Moscow. We did IVF and something called genetic testing, which is adds a couple thousand dollars in the U.S. to the process. And our total bill for the cycle that produced my son was about $3,000, which is close to a tenth of what that would have cost in the U.S.
Some advice that you give readers in the book is gaming the system.
Yes. Recent statistics have shown that the average couple to actually have a baby spends between $60,000 and $70,000 in the U.S. So, you know, I really tried to give some very practical tips financially for what people can do.
Give us one. What's one practical tip?
Well, I'm happy to give you several. One which I didn't learn till very late in the process was that a lot of insurance that won't cover IVF or reproductive procedures will actually cover the tests that will help you figure out what's wrong. And those tests themselves can be very expensive. So one woman, for example, Rose, who I interviewed, who'd spent loads of money and had gone through three cycles, and she'd spent about $70,000 and still didn't know her problems, learned that having her regular OBGYN order diagnostic tests was fully covered by her insurance, while those exact same tests were denied with a fertility clinic. Because if it was seen as fertility, it wasn't treated. But if it was seen as diagnosing a gynecological problem, that was covered. So really simple tricks like that, like getting as many tests covered by insurance as you can, or if you work in the right sector, switching jobs. I spoke extensively with a woman named Rachel, who's in IT, and she figured out that if she got a job at Apple, all of her infertility would be covered. So she switched companies and picked up insurance. And traveling, you know, traveling is a big one, whether that's U.S. or domestic. I spoke with a couple who were from Boston originally, but had their entire professional lives been outside of Massachusetts, and they decided to move back home to Massachusetts where their IVF would be covered, and they have a healthy daughter now. And similarly, you know, traveling to places like Spain, Prague, Russia, there's a host of countries with fabulous IVF programs with very high success rates and much lower costs.
Elizabeth, what about your own body? If you feel that you are not getting pregnant for who knows what reason, what can you do?
Rest is important. Nutrition's important. Getting the right vitamins is important. I mean, there's loads of research now that shows that certain B vitamins, B6 and 12, and omega-3 and CoQ10, they have really important impacts on egg development and egg quality. And egg quality is something I think we really don't focus on enough in this country. That's probably the single most important element I learned in all of my travels to all of these countries, was how much other countries are focused on the quality of eggs over the quantity. And in the U.S., for the most part, many of the doctors and clinics I encountered are focused on the quantity. You know, I think in the U.S. in general, with everything, more is better. But with fertility, is more really better? It only takes one egg to get pregnant. And so getting the healthiest egg possible is a really key part of the process. And that can be things like food, you know, eliminating, you know, plastics with BPA. We've all heard a lot about how BPA is bad. And also really talking to your doctor about the level of hormones. That was my probably single most shocking moment in the fertility journey, was to learn that a lot of the high levels of hormones I'd been injecting through rounds and rounds of IVF may have actually been damaging my eggs, which explained in part why I kept getting pregnant and kept losing them.
Listening to this, Elizabeth, I'm sure some people will be thinking, why didn't Elizabeth decide to adopt? It would seem so much more straightforward and potentially cheaper.
Well, we actually looked at that as well. We went through the adoption process. We were living in the UK at the time, and it's quite an extensive process. Frustratingly, to us, about a year into the process, we were looking at adopting from Russia. Russia closed adoptions to Americans, so that wasn't an option. And I think also, as I said before, because I kept getting pregnant, I just kept feeling like we could have a baby. And I was so frustrated by that. So we were really pursuing everything at once. And her attitude was, whichever works is great with us.
If there's a family listening, a couple listening, and they're trying to get pregnant and it's not working, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that the most important thing is to really take control of the situation. You know, knowledge is power. And what I found in my own experience, and I interviewed dozens and dozens of women and couples and gay and straight couples, is that most people who were successful had like an aha moment. You know, this moment where they realize that they can't just be funneled through the system and they have to take charge. It's asking the right questions and not being afraid to keep asking questions until you understand the answer. So like, what exactly is my problem? Why do you think this protocol is going to work for me? That sounds quite simple, but really forcing the doctor to look at you and not pick one or two protocols off the shelf. A lot of problems are solvable, but it takes a lot of thought and brain power to get to the right solution. And you have to be a proactive part of your own care.
Elizabeth Catkin's new book is called Conceivability: What I Learned Exploring the Frontiers of Fertility. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you very much, Femi.
There's a lot of competition for water from Arizona's Verde River. City dwellers, farmers, kayakers, and environmentalists all want it, farmers especially, because many crops require irrigation in the summer. But a farm in Camp Verde, about 90 miles north of Phoenix, has planted a crop of malt barley, which will use less water than other crops and give Arizona breweries a key ingredient to craft a truly local beer. Melissa Siveny from member station KNAU in Flagstaff reports.
Frontier-style decor covers every inch of the walls at the Coppertop Ale House in downtown Prescott, Arizona. Proprietor Scott Whitney says craft brewing has been a proud tradition in Prescott for more than a century. Even his old-fashioned granite grain mill harkens back to that history.
And it does a great job at milling our grain. So
the freshly crunched malt has a rich, chocolatey smell. It'll add color and flavor to Whitney's next batch of beer. Like other Arizona craft brewers, he's had to order his malt from other states or even other countries. Whitney says he's thrilled to finally have a local supplier of malt.
As soon as they say it's ready, I will be hitching up a trailer and I will be on their doorstep. So I'm ready to go with a checkbook in hand. So yeah, I'm excited.
For Whitney, using local ingredients is a conversation starter with his customers. Every pint he pours is an opportunity to tell a story about how beer could save the Verde River.
There you go, sir.
The Verde flows undammed through central Arizona for more than 100 miles. It's home to native fish and river otters. Kim Shonick is the Verde River Program Manager for the Nature Conservancy.
It's a special place to fish, to swim, to kayak, just to get outdoors. But it's also, importantly, water supply for lots of people.
In Arizona, that's the kind of situation that typically makes farms, cities, and conservationists square off for a fight. But Shonick had a better idea, a business plan.
We kind of came up with this concept of what if we took barley and grew it and malted it and then sold it to local breweries.
Most farms in Camp Verde grow corn or alfalfa, crops that need a lot of water in the hot summer months. But barley is different. It uses less water, and it's irrigated in the spring, when the Verde River is full of snowmelt. Shonick took the idea to local farmer Zach Hauser.
So Zach was willing to step up and plant our first crop of barley.
Yeah, so it's helpful for the Verde because we're not taking any water in the months of June and July. So, you know, anything that we don't use gets spilled right back into the river.
Hauser's family has farmed in Camp Verde since the 60s. For him, protecting the river means protecting the future of his farm.
Yeah, I'm not exaggerating when I say that I love the ground like I love my kids. It's a, you know, it's an honest answer. If we do, you know, these water projects like drip irrigation, we know that if we can do our part in sustaining the river, then farming will always be here on these properties.
But the farm has to make money, too. Once the barley is processed into malt, it fetches high prices at breweries and bakeries. That transformation requires sophisticated equipment at a malt house, and Arizona didn't have one until now.
This is the only malt house in Arizona.
That's Chip Norton, president of Sanawa Malt. He set up the malt house in a warehouse in Camp Verde. Here, barley grains are steeped in water and blasted with air inside giant silver vessels until they sprout. Then they're toasted in a kiln.
It seems odd that we have all this ductwork, all these tanks, valves, process equipment, and it's all about a little grain of barley.
Norton says he got involved with the project because he cares about the Verde River and family farms. But he adds it's a perk that his product also makes great beer.
It's a real low-energy way of doing river conservation, I think, is that someone can quaff a beer and say, well, I'm a conservationist.
If the project pans out financially, that's just what will happen at craft breweries around the state. Half a dozen have already signed up to buy from Sanawa Malt this year. For Here and Now, I'm Melissa Siboney in Flagstaff.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Femi Okeh. This is Here and Now.